Okay, so there's a sort of normal workers' comp experience here. He gets injured, he files a claim, they start making payments, but at some point these payments stop, and that's where things degenerate. And now what? Okay. Okay, so they decide this is how much you've been injured, this is how much you get paid. And he's not happy with that, and he sues them. What's their response? Okay, and that's the one I'm interested in here, where he's suing Scott Wetzel Services, Inc., and his claim in that one says... Okay, so it's... Eventually, we come to this tort of bad faith, you know, like the tort of fraud or the tort of, you know, negligent injury or something like that. Here's the tort of bad faith. And when he files this lawsuit against Scott Wetzel Services claiming they are guilty of the tort of bad faith, their response is what? Understandably. But on what basis do they say that he shouldn't recover? Okay, so the first thing is you can't sue us. You're suing your employer. And his response to that argument is? Right. So the old joke about the guy at the bus stop, you know, and he comes across a dog. You know, does your dog bite? No. Pets the dog, chomp. You know, I thought you said your dog doesn't bite. Well, that's not my dog. You know, well, you can't sue your employer. Well, you're not my employer. What's the court's answer on that issue? That's yeah. What's the court's response? Why? Okay, we get into sort of the technicalities of it, but just on the face of it, what's wrong with the plaintiff's argument that though he cannot sue his employer, he can sue Scott Wetzel Services because they're technically not his employer? The court's answer to that point is... Well, that's actually going to the merits of whether or not the employer could, under some circumstances, be liable. But on the narrow question of whether or not Scott Wetzel Services is an employer or not, they say for legal purposes they are the employer because they stand in the place of the employer. It's as though you had an immunity for Gonzaga University, and somebody sued me saying, well, you're not Gonzaga University, yes, but to the extent that you're suing me for what I did on behalf of Gonzaga University, I get the same immunity as the person for whom I am doing this work. Now, if Scott Wetzel Services had gone essentially outside the course and scope of employment, if Scott Wetzel Services had gone after Mr. Wolf for some tangential reason because, you know, the manager was mad at Wolf for something that happened in a bar someplace, that would be a different case. But to the extent that Scott Wetzel, that the employer could either choose to do this directly or the employer could choose to have somebody do it on their behalf, the Scott Wetzel Services, Inc., essentially stands in the shoes of, so to speak, the employer, therefore is entitled to the same immunity. But there's another argument that the plaintiff has as to why, even if Scott Wetzel Services, Inc. is the employer, they are entitled to sue them. And you're starting to go into that. What's the issue there? You had said earlier there, you know, there is case law authority for the proposition that employees can sue their employer under what circumstances? Okay. That's the plaintiff's argument that that kind of conduct might constitute that, but just in general, while the workers' comp exclusion covers certain kinds of injuries, it doesn't cover other kinds of injuries. The kinds of injuries that it covers are... Okay, but in particular, you could have an injury related to a job that wouldn't be covered under workers' comp. Well, the psychiatric injuries in this case are argued to have flowed from, but what's the kind of, you know, if I'm injured on the job here, there are some kinds of injuries that would be covered under workers' comp and I couldn't sue Gonzaga University. There are other kinds of injuries I might receive where I could sue my employer. Well, you said earlier the characteristic of, you talked about outrageous, the general concept there, yeah, or intentional. That's the dividing line. In other words, accidental injuries. I slip and fall. I bump into something, and light fixture falls on me. I tumble down the stairs. I strain my back trying to lift something. All those accidental injuries are covered within the scope of workers' comp. What's not covered is a punch in the nose. Or if my employer discriminates against me on the basis of race or sex or some other thing. So the workers' comp system was meant to cover accidental injuries. It wasn't meant to cover and therefore exclude injuries where the employer punches me in the nose, either literally or through some kind of harassment or intentional discrimination or something like that. The workers' comp system was never meant to cover that, and therefore those kinds of claims are not barred by the workers' comp statute. So the operative question in this case is, where does a bad faith claim, the allegation that these people deliberately withheld benefits that they knew should have gone to the employee, but they were trying to pinch pennies like, I was listening to a radio ad on the way home the other day from some personal injury firm. You know, the insurance companies, what are they out to do? They're out to, save every penny they can, but we, schmo, will get you what you deserve. If the insurance company is behaving in that way, which is the plaintiff's allegation here, knowing that this guy deserved workers' comp benefits, they refused to pay him, does that fall within the intentional area that would exclude it from coverage from the workers' comp thing, and therefore it would be okay? Or is it within the scope of the statute and therefore is barred by the workers' comp exclusion? That's the question before the House. And how does the court answer that question? And what is their guiding light here? What's their path or by what authority? What do they look to try to figure out how to draw the line between what's covered and what's not covered? To some extent, it's cases, but the cases in turn depend upon. Exactly. It's the statute. That is, to the extent that the legislature has ruled things in or ruled things out, the court wants to try to implement that scheme. And what's the best evidence in this case that the legislature intended these kinds of claims not to be separately the subject of a tort suit, but belonged within the scheme of the Industrial Insurance Act? How do we know that? Yeah. And that's the very big picture overview, but with respect to whether bad faith claims should be within the system or left outside the system, we know that they wanted it inside the system. Ms. Townsend? Right. There's a remedy within the statute for this very kind of behavior. At least that's what the court finds. Now, you could imagine, as you were saying earlier, really outrageous conduct in which you have memos in the file from Scott Wetzel Services saying, I know Wolf deserves this money, but we're going to, you know, we want to teach him and other people like him a lesson and therefore don't pay it. You know, that would be outrageous, but where in effect the employer's trying to save money resolves a doubtful claim by refusing to pay instead of paying in cases of doubt, that's remedied by these penalties to say if eventually we find you've been too stingy, you're going to pay double or whatever the remedy is. So when the court sees that, they think the legislature meant for cases like this, short of this, you know, totally outrageous discriminatory sort of stuff, meant for this to stay within the system. Now, again, the courts have to kind of tend to this boundary between actions that fall within the sort of normal course of employment and those things that ought to be separately addressed in by tort claims. And the whole area of discrimination or harassment or, you know, stressful environments, if you work, for example, as a law enforcement officer in a very stressful environment and there are all kinds of things that make you prone toward alcoholism or toward other kinds of things, and you allege that this on-the-job, you know, situation caused you to have these psychological problems or physical problems that led to psychological problems and so forth, how does the court know which things are covered and which things aren't? How about situations in which people claim to be the victims of on-the-job discrimination, but those things are not clear, but the person is still claiming psychological trauma and injury? Is that covered by workers' comp? Does it go outside the system? Can the employee double dip, et cetera? The other problem that we're going to come to in Chapter 6 is how you relate a claim against the employer to a claim against a, for example, a product manufacturer, or as in Schoenberger versus Roberts, just an ordinary automobile collision. If, in fact, this claim is covered by workers' comp, and there's immunity for the liability here, that's shielded from any kind of imposition of tort damages, what happens if the plaintiff also has a claim? Plaintiff gets injured because a pipe falls on him, and the pipe falling on him was caused by a defective belt or chain or crane or something that collapsed. In the suit against the product manufacturer, how do you allocate the fault? Does the product manufacturer have to pay everything less whatever has been received? Does the product manager have to pay, or manufacturer have to pay everything and then reimburse workers' comp? You know, what happens if you suspect that the employer has been guilty of some sort of negligence on their own, which drops out of the equation if you're simply talking about workers' comp, but if you're talking about comparing a defective crane to some kind of, abuse of the system by the employer, how do we make these things fit together? How do you blend a no-fault system on the one hand with a system that's based on the allocation of fault, as we'll talk about in Chapter 6? So there are problems that we have to look at down the road, in terms of figuring out how the workers' comp system relates to other aspects of the tort system. But for the moment, at least, we at least have this concept that, okay, to the extent it is a claim against the employer and it's an ordinary negligence claim as distinguished from some sort of intentional injury, well, to that extent, it's going to be barred by the workers' comp immunity. Now, the last note on page 417, spilling over to page 18, has to do with a case that raised a lot of eyebrows when it came down. I think the court has since backed away from this concept, but in Berkeley, they recognized a claim against the employer after the employees alleged that there was what the employees called intentional injury. And the court said, yeah, that might constitute an intentional injury. The problem is that the employer never intended to. It was not like a punch in the nose, but it was a situation where the employees complain about the condition. The employer sends the employee back into this hazardous environment, and the employee suffers harm. Is that, does that fall outside the workers' comp exclusion? The court said, well, it just might. And a lot of people got worried at that point because when you think about it, lots of times employers tell employees, stop whining and get back to work. Yeah, I know it's cold out there. I know it's, sort of slippery now that the temperatures drop below 32. Or it's wet and it's been raining, and so that walkway is kind of slippery. I know that stuff is heavy, etc. But you'll be fine. Just go out there and do it. How do you distinguish that kind of case, which frequently accompanies injury? Sometimes the employer is taken by surprise, but oftentimes the employer is aware that the employee faces a risk by climbing up on a ladder or getting on a roof or lifting something heavy or driving a piece of equipment on unstable ground, and lo and behold, the thing they were worried about happens. Does that constitute intentional injury? I don't think so. Again, it's sort of the Pinto case of trying to figure out, well, what's different about this case to distinguish it from the large number of cases in which people make perhaps bad judgments about proceeding ahead with some risk. But do you really want those kinds of cases taken out of the workers' comp system and thrown into the tort area? So again, this whole area is kind of unsettled the extent to which you can avoid the workers' comp immunity by alleging some sort of intentional or quasi-intentional conduct. Any questions about the employer immunity or other aspects of Chapter 4? Okay, let's press on then to Chapter 5. And I want to emphasize the way in which I've heretofore kind of waved you off of the contributory fault issues. I've both for exam purposes and otherwise, to the extent that you've had this impulse of identifying the plaintiff's fault as a relevant factor in the case, I've said, you know, don't go there. Don't go there yet, anyway. Now I do want you to go there. And to think about, okay, there are cases in which the defendant is negligent or otherwise subject to some kind of liability, but on top of that, or at the same time, in addition to that, the plaintiff also could be blamed for part or all of this injury. And so the question is, what sort of principles should guide our evaluation or resolution of those cases in which the plaintiff has proven some kind of breach of duty by the defendant that proximately caused the plaintiff's injury, but the defendant turns around and says, same goes for you. You negligently caused your own injury. The other thing we're going to be looking at, particularly in the first part of this chapter, is the development of this body of law through the common law and into modern times. As we've seen before in wrongful death or sovereign immunity, the common law took an approach to this issue which, in light of more modern circumstances, people don't feel really works anymore. Courts don't feel it works anymore. But that may or may not be something that the courts can remedy. So there again, the whole issue about how a court addresses a situation where they don't particularly like the law they have inherited, but they're not sure what to do about it. So we start with Harrison versus Montgomery County. Can somebody tell us about Harrison? Mr. Lynch. On what theory is the school board? And again, we'd have all the Chapter 1 issues about, you know, what would a reasonable person do in these circumstances? How do we measure the standard of reasonable care? But let's assume we could solve those, that the plaintiff could satisfy the jury that, in fact, the school board's employees, the teacher on the ground there, didn't use the standard of reasonable care or didn't meet the standard of reasonable care and would be found negligent. Nonetheless, the school board says we're not liable because, okay, which is? Yeah. That, okay, maybe we were negligent, but so were you, plaintiff. You didn't use reasonable care for your safety. And the rule that the court has inherited, and they give you some historical background here, was that a plaintiff who was himself or herself at fault in causing their injury could not recover Now, what's the plaintiff's argument as to why the court shouldn't follow that rule? Okay. Okay, and just so we understand the argument about why it's unfair, the defendant says, okay, maybe I'm negligent, but so were you. Therefore, we pay nothing, and in effect, you pay everything. And the plaintiff's response to that is, well, why is it that if I'm negligent and you're negligent, we decide that all of the responsibility for this accident falls on me? Particularly, I could understand it if the jury was asked to decide, well, which of these two is more negligent, and the one who's more negligent has to pay everything. But is it the rule, says the plaintiff, that if I'm even slightly at fault and the jury would otherwise find that the school board is mostly at fault, I still get nothing. And the school board essentially pays nothing. Is that the rule? Yeah, that in a sense, the plaintiff says, I'm willing to pay my share here, but I don't think I should have to pay everything. So what's the defendant's answer to that claim that this is an unfair system that singles out the plaintiff to shoulder all the blame when the jury found that both of these parties were at fault? Yeah. And the kind of response we've heard in other circumstances? And go down the street. Yeah. You know, a great argument. We'd vote for this. You know, you offer a bill in the legislature to replace the contributory negligence rule with the comparative negligence rule, I'd vote for it in a heartbeat, but hey, I'm not a legislator, I'm a judge. And if you want this changed, you got to go to the legislature. Dr. Lawley? And going back to the snowmobile case, what standard would we apply to this 14-year-old? Right. Now, could a jury find that a 14-year-old failed to use reasonable care for his own safety, taking into account the fact that he's not a reasonably prudent adult, he's a reasonably prudent 14-year-old in junior high school, not wanting to look like a wuss in front of his friends, trying to demonstrate his skill and strength and so forth? Could a jury still find under those circumstances that he was negligent? Yeah, and they did. So age could be a factor. It would help the plaintiff make the argument, all things considered, the plaintiff didn't act negligently. The plaintiff was doing what 14-year-olds are supposed to be doing in this kind of environment, and you hope, given the state of the law here, that the jury will see it your way, but the jury didn't. The jury found that he acted negligently. So again, the court looks at this and says, we can't help you. This is the law that has been handed down to us, and we're stuck. Okay, similar kind of issue comes up in Lee versus Yellow Cab. Same basic historical background. but obviously a very different outcome. And we'll sort of move back and forth between these two cases because we're sort of contrasting the very different conclusions that these two courts draw from essentially the same kind of evidence or the same historical background. There may simply be different temperament among the judges on these two courts. Can somebody tell us about Mrs. Lee? Mr. Stubbs. Okay. What's the defendant's answer when he? Okay, so plaintiff says you were negligent. The defendant says, well, I don't think I was, but even if you decide I'm negligent, I think it was partially your fault too, and under the principle of contributory negligence, if the jury finds that you're partially at fault, you lose. What happens at trial? Okay.
And at trial, what happens then is that the court overturns the contributory negligence and adopts the negligence.
When we get further up the food chain, but the trial judge who's got Mrs. Lee suing the cab company, what does the trial judge do? What do you think a trial judge would do? Yeah, this is above my pay grade. You know, I'm just a trial judge here. Appellate courts can do stuff. But, you know, as a trial judge, I'm supposed to apply the law that's been given to me. Again, I'd happily vote for this if I were elevated to some, you know, place higher on the food chain, my pay grade got raised, maybe I could make this decision, but I just do what I'm told. Okay, so the case goes to trial. What does the jury say? Well, the trial court gives the jury the instructions on, you know, here's what you're supposed to find. What does the jury find as a matter of fact? Right. Finds both parties to be negligent, and therefore the trial judge again applies the rule saying, I'm sorry, Mrs. Lee, but the jury found that you were negligent. You get nothing. And Mrs. Lee then says, as the plaintiff did in the previous case, I'm taking this upstairs. I'm going up, you know, to where the folks with a higher pay grade have the authority to say this rule stinks and we're going to get a new one. And again, the plaintiff's argument to the California Supreme Court is that the rule stinks. It's a bad rule. It's been around for a long time, but it's a bad rule. And the court ought to change it. Now, there's a different kind of wrinkle in this particular case, peculiarity of California law, which the court has to spend a little time on. Let's talk about that just so we're... we don't ignore this part of it. What's different about California compared to the case in Maryland? Mr. Rubio? Okay, there's actually a statute on this point. So that instead of simply being the inheritance of Butterfield versus Forrester, where Lord Mansfield says this, you know, negligent plaintiffs can't recover, we additionally, at least the defendant says, look, this is not a case where the legislature has been silent. The legislature's actually said something. What did the legislature say that's relevant here? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, section footnote 6 mentioned section 1714, which states anyone is responsible not only for the result of his willful act, but also for the injury occasioned to him by his want of ordinary care, skill, and the management of his property.
Stop right there. That expresses what does that express? That's just the ordinary rule of negligence. It says if you're negligent, you are liable. Now we have a qualifier to that. You're liable for your negligence. What's the rest of that?
Except so far as the latter has willfully or by want of ordinary care brought to injury upon himself.
Okay. That's the key language that the defendant says. See, the legislature made the contributory negligence rule part of a statute, and therefore it's set in concrete. You can't simply say, oh, we used to think this, but we don't think it anymore. It's not just stare decisis anymore, according to the defendant. This is now a matter of statutory law. What's the court's answer to that argument? That they have been excluded from further meddling with this. Mr. Stubbs. Okay, the court says in effect, well, you know, there are statutes and then there are statutes. There are those kinds of statutes where the legislature is saying, you know, now hear this. This is what we want, but this kind of statute, they say, is a different kind of statute. What kind of statute is this? It's a sort of summary, or, you know, it's like a little précis or outline. You know, it's almost like the restatement, according, they don't use that phrase, but you sort of get the impression that the court regards this kind of statute as though it were a sort of restatement of the law, so that the legislature did us all a favor, instead of having to paw through all these moldy old case books and dredge up, you know, find cases and try to index them and put them together. The legislature kind of summarized, okay, here are the general principles of contract law, of tort law, of property law, etc., so that you can have them in one nice convenient place. Did we mean for this to be the be-all and end-all of the, you know, the latest? No, we just sort of wanted to kind of throw it out there for you to chew on. Well, you know, that's sort of an interesting way for the court to take this, and some of you may have studied in political science or history or elsewhere the difference between civil law systems and common law systems, and there's a whole historical jurisprudential sort of fight. You may know that Napoleon, for example, the Napoleonic Code, which was written in the early 19th century, was a response to the whole kind of democratic impulse, a rejection of this kind of common law system, where a lot of political theorists thought the only real legitimate power came from legislatures. Again, a sort of a French concept, the kind of polarized reaction of the French Revolution, this rejection of hierarchy and of, you know, tradition and of you know, all the sort of sense of corruption and oppression that went with that, and that what was really legitimate was what came from the people through their legislature. That was the supreme power. And there's always been a conflict between that view, the sort of pure democracy, as distinguished from the English, you know, the Edmund Burke idea that, you know, democracy has its appeal, but you got to put it in its rightful place, and you got to hedge it with all these other sorts of restrictions. So some of this reflects the way in which a sort of ambivalence about the idea of a civil law system, which looks to the legislature primarily or almost exclusively as the source of authority, as opposed to those common law systems where we say there's a kind of wisdom and a kind of authority that comes out of courts. Courts sort of organically developing these principles, not basing them upon a specific statute, not limiting our law to what's found in statutes, but what comes from generic universal principles. Common law and natural law have a certain sort of affinity, although that's another issue too. So again, there's a big, very big issue going on here, bigger than this particular case, but California's history was a sort of, as you may know, California was originally a Spanish colony, inherited much of sort of Spanish law like community property, which was foreign to the whole common law. We have sort of, we refer to as common law jurisdictions and community property jurisdictions. California and Washington are among the community property states, which we inherited from our Western, or actually from Spanish, you know, the early days where community property was the law, and so forth. So there's this whole sort of historical thing in what was going on there. But in any event, we've got this statute back here in the middle of the 19th century, and the court essentially pushes that aside, saying, no, it's not like a real statute. We're still free to go change it as we see fit. Interestingly, of course, as you read the statute, you could do a lot with just the language of the statute. You don't have to blow the statute off and say, you know, that was just a sort of set of notes from the legislature on, you know, somebody's lectures on tort law. You could actually read this to say, well, you're liable for your negligence except so far as. That sounds like something that would admit of degrees. It doesn't say except when you are responsible for your own injury. It says except so far as. So if the court thought, well, you know, at the time people interpreted this according to the old common law rule, but we now interpret this in light of more modern things. We don't just say we're not bound by it and we can continue to evolve it. We're just going to reinterpret that language the way you reinterpret something like, you know, the First Amendment. If the First Amendment says, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of the press, we interpret that to include the internet, cable TV, etc. We don't think we're doing any violence to the Constitution. We're not ignoring the Constitution. We think that when you say freedom of speech and freedom of the press, you're also including things like TV stations. They're not outside the scope of the protection of the First Amendment, even though they're not literally speech and they're not literally press. Okay, so again, the court gets by this question about its own authority and treats this as a question for their considered judgment as to whether or not they're going to continue to follow it. And in addition to the argument that the system would be unfair if it placed all the responsibility on the plaintiff rather than allocating it between the plaintiff and the defendant, there are other reasons why the court thinks this rule is a bad rule. It's not just unfair. What other things are wrong with this old contributory negligence rule?
Involving more than one party, they're responsible when there's more than one responsible party.
Actually, that's a sort of that's another issue they realize they're going to have to deal with. But before we get to the question of how we're going to implement this system, the other they're trying to convince us why they've got to make this change. Whereas the Maryland court said, you know, this is too big for us. Take it. Go ahead. Yes.
And also that contracts with the public's confidence and ability and ability of the court to assign liability on a consistent basis.
It has a corrupting effect because the rule is so harsh, the court notes, as a practical matter, juries will try to find a way around it. And as they say, experienced trial lawyers know the juries, once they sort of figure out the way the system works, juries will make compromises of their own. They'll find for the plaintiff, find no contributory negligence, but then reduce the amount of damages. They want to do the right thing, and if following the letter of the law would lead them to do something they believe is unjust, the jury's going to navigate around it. And this has, you know, once the jury starts kind of not trusting the rules that they are given, what else are they going to include? They were supposed, you know, well, technically we're supposed to ignore this, but gee, it seems to me, in other words, you want the jury to be able to trust the system. And if the system is not really trustworthy because it doesn't reflect our innate sense of what would be fair, then we're undermining the public's confidence in the way the jury system works. So that's another reason, in addition to the fact that I don't happen to like this rule, there's the principle, look at what it's doing to our system. Okay, so for these and other reasons, the court says, we're going to bite the bullet and we're going to change this. But once they've sort of got the concept in their mind, okay, the bar is now open, let's talk about what this new rule is going to look like. In many ways, this is reminiscent of Vanderpool and the kind of, you know, now we're sort of acting in quasi-legislative mode here, and we have to consider the sorts of issues, the specifics of a new rule. What are the things we're going to have to come up with here?
A resolution for when there's more than one party
possible. Okay. I'm actually going to put that a little further down the list here, multiple parties, because before we get to that one, there are other questions about what this system is going to look like. That's also sort of in I would consider sort of the cleanup part of it. Mr. Christopoulos? Yeah, if we're going to adopt comparative negligence, the first question is, of the major varieties, what's on the menu here? What are our choices?
The choices are pure and comparative.
Yes, that's the pure and what?
Pure and
modified, yeah. So the first question is, which variety? Now tell me what the difference is here.
Pure is when the plaintiff can recover no matter what his degree of liability. If it's 80%, he can recover, but he will only recover 20%.
Correct. As opposed to a modified system, what's the deal with modified? Okay, there are two subdivisions of that, but the general concept of a modified comparative fault system is...
There are more at fault than the defendant.
Yeah, there comes a point where your fault as a plaintiff is so great, we're not going to do business with you anymore. Whereas the pure system says, it doesn't matter, though your sins be as scarlet, we'll still deal with you. True, you won't get very much if you're really, really negligent. Your percentage is going to get smaller and smaller, but there is no point at which we say, no, sorry, you're out. Whereas in a modified system, there is tolerance for some degree of fault, but somewhere around that 50% mark, you don't start getting less, you start getting nothing. So there's this kind of gradual incline, you know, like a beach that goes out, and then all of a sudden it just drops. Okay. Of those two, which is the better system? Since we, this California Supreme Court, are now kind of writing on a clean slate, what do we like here? Which is a better system? Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a general question as interpreted by the California court. Ms. Woodruff, you had your hand up? Why is that better? Okay, the principle the court thinks is preferable is let liability follow fault. You know, if you're 80% at fault, you bear 80% of the damages. If you're 20% at fault, you bear 20% of the damages. We're just going to let the chips fall where they may. Why have some arbitrary cutoff? They attribute the arbitrary cutoff not to its theoretical benefits, not to its philosophical merits. Why does the California court think modified comparative fault is found anywhere? Where do we get modified comparative fault if it's Mr. Henderson?
I think they mentioned that, that some people with modified fault struck them as more fair.
Okay, and who would those be? But in particular, it would be the defendants and the insurance interests that would fight any form of comparative negligence, and modified was kind of a compromise, as between no comparative fault system and one that was modified, better to have a modified system than none at all. So the court picks up the commentator's argument that the reason we get modified comparative fault is because the insurance lobby is so powerful that they insisted on this as a condition of getting the thing through the legislature. Without that, it was dead on arrival. So you go back to Maryland, where time after time people introduce bills to change the law and they can't get it through. Finally, somebody says, well, look, we'll just kind of, we'll do this a little more gradually here. So again, the difference is not so much that some people, at least this is according to the court here, that this is, that the modified system is better, but rather it's more politically saleable. But it's very popular. And lots of people would say, in effect, it's one thing to allow a person who's a little bit at fault to still get a recovery. That's better than being barred. But once somebody's more negligent than the defendant, why is the defendant paying for the plaintiff's harm? So it does appeal to some people's sense of fairness, but in general, that's not its primary appeal, at least according to this court. The primary appeal is it's the way we get stuff done in the legislature. People give a little bit. They can't get everything they want, but they get a little bit of what they want. Okay, so we've decided in California we're going to take a pure approach. What else do we need to know before we get this show on the road? We eventually get to multiple. They also have a question about how we phrase this or by what standard, you know, what kind of jury instructions are we going to use? And the court says, oh, they'll come up with those. You know, this is just sort of cleanup work that somebody will be able to phrase this to juries. Juries know what to do. And in fact, on that point, I think the court is quite right. Juries instinctively know how to allocate fault. They can. And once you sort of give them the authorization, assign each party a share of fault according to what you think is a fair distribution, they're quite happy to do that. Okay, so essentially the formula, and the court says, we'll send it off to the people who do jury instructions. And they get one, and it comes back. Okay, now let's talk about multiple parties. What's the problem here? Well, let's just take the simple case. You got Mrs. Lee, and let's say the jury says that the cab driver is 40% at fault and Mrs. Lee is 60% at fault. Who gets what? Let's suppose the defendant's damages are $5,000 and Mrs. Lee's damages are $10,000. How much does the cab driver get from Mrs. Lee? He gets actually $3,000. He gets 60% of his damages, so he gets $3,000. She gets 40% of $10,000. She gets, with a two-party system, however this falls out, we just say you pay according to your share. What's the problem with multiple defendants? Yes. What happens if you've got the cab driver, but you also have some other driver who maybe, you know, it's a hit-and-run case or a so-called phantom driver. This guy swerves to avoid somebody, but that driver drives off and nobody can find him again. But their negligence set this whole thing in motion. What do we do if there's a car mechanic who failed to, you know, properly adjust the brakes and that's what causes the accident, but the guy's speeding too? What do we do about things like joint and several liability? If a plaintiff is at fault, do they still get joint and several liability? What happens if one of the defendants settles? Inquiring minds want to know. What does the court say to those inquiring minds? That and that's again when we're but how will the people who write the jury instructions know what to tell the, you know, what kind of instructions do you want us to write? Do you want us to write on the issue of multiple parties? The court has a relatively simple answer, not very satisfying. Ms. Sharp, we'll get back to you. You know. Just stay tuned here. We're not done, you know. God isn't finished with me yet, says the court, in effect. We know what we think about some things, but with respect to other things, we haven't made up our mind. And as a general principle of judicial decision-making, judges prefer a case, and in fact, there's some constitutional requirement, things like justiciability and standing, which say, in effect, the court is not supposed to render advisory opinions. The court is supposed to decide cases based upon real litigated issues in a case. They're afraid of having phony, made-up suits where people pose, you know, something and deliberately kind of, like going back to Bora versus American Airlines, they get some case up there that's the wrong case that's going to lead them astray. They want a good case, well argued, ably presented, the best arguments, this whole adversary system working at its finest so that we can make the best decision. If we were to decide that issue today, we'd be speculating. Well, we're already doing a fair amount of speculating, but we don't want to do any more of it than we've already done. So again, multiple parties, we say, in effect, it's fourth down, you know, we'll just punt. Put it off. Now, if you've read into Chapter 6, you'll notice that we get there. We finally do come back to this issue, an American Motorcycle versus Superior Court. That's the case 3 years later. 3 years after this opinion, the court finally follows through on its promise. We will address this at a later date. And in the meantime, everybody's wondering, what is the rule here? Okay. You mentioned something else which has to do with Yeah, and I think we dealt with that here. You said something about willful misconduct. Yeah, willful misconduct. Is there a difference between ordinary negligence? You know, what happens if the cab driver, instead of just going a little too fast, is going way too fast, or the cab driver is, you know, playing, you know, he's gotten into a little bit of road rage with somebody who tried to cut him off, and he's engaged not just in negligent conduct, but in something we would call willful misconduct. Does that change our allocation? What does the court say about that? Okay. Is that, will that remain true here? What do they say they're going to do now that they've, see, it used to be the case that contributory negligence didn't affect the claim. Now that we have comparative negligence, will we? Okay, but I think what they wind up doing, do they not, is to punt again. We don't have a case like that here. Let's see here. Yeah, okay, that's basically yeah, I think somewhere they say, in effect, they're going to punt. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right. Right, so in middle of page 15, right-hand column, two of the indicated areas, multiple parties and willful misconduct, are not before us. We're not going to tell you what we think about that. We'll get back to you, essentially, is what the court says. Okay, and then they talk about the precise form they're going to use. They're going to do pure or modified. We're going to do the pure form. Then there's also something here about last clear chance. This is in the right-hand column on page 16, about a third of the way down. I'm never quite sure what to do about last clear chance. It's a very, I actually talk about it in one of the articles that I've put on your tort CD. It's the article about, I think the article on assumption of risk. So I mentioned last clear chance. Those articles, by the way, two of them, the one on one that's called several liability, that article, and the one on assumption of risk would, I think, be worth reading. I think they're a fairly clear summary of the history of the law in this area. And again, last clear chance was sort of an anomaly of the old common law system. It really doesn't have any relevance anymore. Assumption of risk does remain an issue, and we'll come back to that later on in this chapter. In fact, that's actually something we've got to do next, isn't it? But just to finish up what the court is doing here, they're adopting a pure system. They're going to come up with jury instructions that reflect that. They're going to resolve later on the principle of how this applies to multiple parties, willful misconduct, and the like. How it exactly relates to assumption of risk, they haven't clarified, but to the extent that assumption of risk is simply another form of contributory negligence, they say it'll be treated just like contributory negligence. I want to emphasize the fact that I continue to use that term, contributory negligence, as though it survived the abandonment of the contributory negligence rule, which is true. Courts, statutes still use the term contributory negligence. What's changed is the way it's treated. Under the old rule, it was a bar. All but a handful of states, Maryland being one, all but a handful of states have adopted a statute that uses the comparative negligence principle. And for purposes of the exam, I will give you a statute or statutory provisions addressing the issue of comparative fault. So the thing we'll do when we start Chapter 6 is go through typical comparative fault statutes so you learn to kind of read them and make sense of them. The final thing here, just before we break on Lee versus Yellow Cab, is Justice Clark's dissent. And we'll see his dissent again in Chapter 6, where Justice Clark says, judicial arrogance. This is something for the legislature. And again, we see this continuing dispute about what role judges ought to play when judges are confronted with rules they believe are out of step with changed society. So let's take our 10-minute break, and we'll come back and look at assumption of risk.